Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I'm Tyrus.
I'm Liz Claman.
I'm Greg Jarrett. And this is the Fox News Rundown.
Friday, April 14th, 2023. I'm Jared Halpern. An abortion pill prescribed by doctors for more than 20 years is facing new legal uncertainty with court rulings reconsidering the FDA's approval process.
I can't imagine a more compelling case for the Supreme Court to give an expedited review. I mean, these are women who are facing very important choices across the country.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. How long will we live? In this country, not as long as we used to. Life expectancy in the U.S. dropped last year, and while COVID played a role, other factors did too, and those are now also contributing to increased deaths among children.
What we are seeing as a medical society is increased suicides and increased homicides, as well as increased deaths from motor vehicle accidents. So when we talk about there is a mental health and a violence crisis in the United States, our children are the biggest victims.
And I'm Will Kane, and I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
It could soon be up to the Supreme Court to figure out the future of a drug used by women to induce an abortion for more than 20 years. A series of court rulings have blocked and then narrowed the scope of mifepristone. Mifepristone has been prescribed by doctors for more than two decades as part of a two-pill regimen to terminate a pregnancy. Late last week, a federal judge in Texas blocked the FDA's approval of the drug, arguing the agency did not adequately consider health risk when approving the drug in 2000. A three-judge appeals panel partially overruled that decision, allowing the FDA's approval to stand, but reducing how long into a pregnancy it can be used and prohibiting the drug from being dispensed by mail. The Justice Department has signaled an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the administration remains committed to keeping open legal pathways to reproductive care.
We believe that the law is on our side and we will prevail. So I can reassure the American people that that is our commitment to women, millions of women across the country.
Pharmaceutical executives and some U.S. health officials warn if the ruling stands, it could put in jeopardy other drugs commonly used by Americans. And some lawmakers have even suggested the FDA ignore the court rulings.
The FDA approval here occurred years ago, and it's only now being challenged because of the ruling in Dobbs.
Jonathan Turley is a professor at George Washington University Law School and a Fox News contributor.
Many of us are skeptical about the decision of the trial judge, not only in finding that this may violate federal law, but to enjoin the use of this medication. The Fifth Circuit, in my view, correctly lifted that injunction in terms of the use of the medication, but they kept in place some of the other elements of the decision, specifically requiring that it be used earlier in the pregnancy and that you reinforcing the consultation with physicians.
I guess that's where I wanted to lead this conversation, right? Why is this the role of a federal court? This isn't a legal question. This is a medical question, isn't it?
Well, you know, it's not the first time that those questions overlap. And you can see that in this 42-page opinion in the case, which is called Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA. And the courts often have to look at whether agencies fulfilled their requirements for policies and procedures according to federal law. And that means that courts sometimes have to question whether they've established a legitimate basis for actions being taken by an agency like the FDA. In this case, the court did note that the medical profession is very clear that they believe that this is a safe medication. What the court did is it sort of ended up with a split decision in that it lifted the most harsh aspects of the injunction. So it allows this medication to be used while limiting the time period in which it can be used. That means that the administration can still move forward with seeking an injunction on those other elements. And they may, in fact, do that.
One of the things that this appeals court did in limiting the ability for mifepristone to be mailed to patients was they cited the Comstock Act. What is that? It's an old law, isn't it?
Well, the Comstock Act from 1873 was a law that made it unlawful to disseminate birth control through the mail or across state lines. It's one of those sleeper statutes that is still on the books. The court had to sort of balance that because it's still on the books against these claims of the use of this medication by mail. You know, the important thing about this is that it goes to how some states have sought to cut off the circumvention of Dobbs by advocacy groups and by the federal government. So, you know, a minority of states are moving to largely restrict or prohibit abortion, but over 50% of the abortions in the country are done by medication. So the federal government can effectively blunt those state laws by using this type of mail order medication treatment. So some states want to stop that. And this case succeeded to a degree that surprised many of us. I don't believe that this is a good ruling by the trial court. I expect that the Fifth Circuit will be upheld in enjoining the bar on the use of the drug. Mm-hmm. But I also expect that federal courts are likely to support the mailing of this medication. Now, there's also the issue that the court is allowing the medication to be used in the first 7 weeks of the pregnancy. FDA expanded that to 10 weeks. So there was a reduction of 3 weeks in the use of the medication. Once again, that creates this conflict between what doctors consider to be medically beneficial and what some people think is legally flawed.
What would be the legal rationale for saying that the FDA can't expand the time period in which this drug can be used?
Well, the FDA, when it made these changes, did not go through an elaborate administrative process. It didn't establish how it was doing this. And or at least in terms of things like the APA and other laws. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, the FDA just sort of made this decision on its sole authority. And what the trial court said was that I don't see the foundation for this federal action. And there's questions being raised by these other parties that you ignored what could be potentially harmful uses of this drug. And their argument is if you're mailing these drugs to people, it increases the danger that it can be used in a harmful way. We haven't seen that statistically. So part of the problem I have with the trial court is that the record seemed to me rather thin on showing that there was this significant threat to the health of individuals. But clearly, by mailing this medication, you increase the chances that very young people could use it, that there might be complications. Those are issues that the FDA set aside, but the court said, well, maybe that was too quick. Maybe we need to look at it.
Let me ask you about some of the other legal implications here. You had hours after this trial, this district court judge in Texas issued his ruling, a judge in Washington State basically tell the FDA not to restrict access to this. So you have conflicting opinions. You have now a Fifth Circuit appeals court opinion. All of this to me, seems like this is headed for the Supreme Court. What would be the question here for the Supreme Court if it reaches that level?
Well, there's two aspects that could bring a Supreme Court review. First of all, the Supreme Court does look for conflicts between the circuits. This is a little early because it's a conflict of trial judges. Mm. Often the Supreme Court likes to see the circuits take the first bite at the apple on appeal to hash out any differences. But the Supreme Court will also intervene when there is a matter of great national importance, one where expedition is really warranted. I can't imagine a more compelling case for the Supreme Court to give an expedited review. I mean, these are women who are facing very important choices across the country. And I can't imagine the court just saying, well, let the circuits work it out. So I do think that there's a chance the court could intervene early here. The other thing that might prompt them to do it is that this involves national injunctions. And the Supreme Court is really hot on this issue. I mean, to a point.
I know a lot of the legal community is, right? These single district court judges basically being able to make rulings that affect areas far larger than sort of their area of jurisprudence.
Yeah, and, you know, one can understand the district court here says, look, if I think that this is an invalid rule, it's invalid across the country. But the Supreme Court, including conservative justices, have told lower courts to knock this off, that they don't like these national injunctions, that they're creating great disruption across the country, requiring the Supreme Court to intervene more than it should need to. And this has come up spontaneously. There was a recent case where Justice Gorsuch and a couple of his colleagues just spontaneously started to ask opposing counsel about national injunctions when they weren't really that relevant to the argument. And I remember sitting there saying, my God, these folks are really hot on this issue.
They're looking for a reason to get to say something about it.
That's right. And so this thing pops out, and I think people like the Justice Gorsuch and others are very likely to want to see it. So I think that all the elements are here for an expedited review by the Supreme Court. I certainly would grant one if I was a justice.
I'll finish with this. We heard from the HHS Secretary Javier Becerra, who warned that if courts can undermine the FDA's approval of this drug, they could undermine the FDA's approval of other drugs that Americans rely on. Does this set that precedent?
Yeah, I was not as persuaded by that. It seemed to me an effort to do a jump scare for voters. This is a reality of looking at agency action. The FDA can't say that you can review every other agency action except ours because we have doctors. You know, what the court was looking at was whether this agency fulfilled and met federal law. You know, I have friends all the time. I teach torts, so it's ironic that I have so many doctors as close friends. But they often will lecture me on how courts and lawyers tell them how to do medicine when you don't know anything about it. And I often tell them, and I tell my students this when it comes up, we're not experts on medicine. We're experts on risk, and we're experts on the law. And we don't have to be a train conductor to handle a case on trains. We don't have to be a pilot to handle a case on airlines. We look at what is required by the law, and in some cases, what is acceptable risk. That's our sort of our wheelhouse of expertise. So I don't accept that criticism. Just because it's the FDA doesn't mean that they get carte blanche in any agency decisions that they make. That doesn't mean I agree with the district court decision here. I don't. I think the court got this one wrong.
Well, it's a fascinating case. Medicine, politics, the law, all kind of coming together. And I appreciate you, Professor Turley, for helping make sense of it. We'll continue to have these conversations. It seems like we haven't heard the last word on this case.
I expect not. Thank you very much.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
This is Will Cain with your Fox News commentary coming up.
Last year, we were told U.S. life expectancy dropped again. The year before the pandemic, life expectancy in this country was 79. Then COVID hit, and in 2020, it dropped down to 77 years of age. But then in 2022, while other countries that saw drops were rebounding, we did not, and life expectancy is now just over 76. But then in mid-March, and the Journal of the American Medical Association, or JAMA, says pediatric mortality is on the rise as well. Now, the study authors write between 2019 and 2020, the all-cause mortality rate for ages 1 to 19 increased by nearly 11%. And it increased again by more than 8% between 2020 and 2021. This, they say, is being driven primarily by injuries that, especially among teens, suicides, homicides, and overdoses are all increasing.
Well, certainly across the entire globe, just about every country saw increased deaths throughout the pandemic.
Dr. Nicole Sapphire is a Fox News medical contributor.
And one of the things that we were really looking for is, you know, we saw 2020 things, you had a lot more deaths, but what happened in 2021? And 2021, unfortunately, especially here in the United States, we actually still saw a good amount of that increased death. And specifically with children, the life expectancy went down, but we need to make sure that we separate COVID and the childhood deaths, because COVID is not to blame for the increased childhood deaths. You've already listed them. What we are seeing as a medical society is increased suicides and increased homicides, as well as increased deaths from motor vehicle accidents. So when we talk about there is a mental health and a violence crisis in the United States, our children are the biggest victims.
This American Medical Association paper does cite mental health, as you said, specifically mental illness and a shortage of mental health and substance abuse professionals, specifically in rural areas. Is that a money problem? Like, if the Safer Communities Act has a bunch of money in it for mental health, and that was passed last year, is it a matter of getting some professionals trained and out to those areas, or is it deeper than that?
Reach in rural communities has always been a struggle for the healthcare industry. One of the good things that we actually did see was this expanded use of telehealth platforms, and it was incredible. Prior to COVID, we really had a lot of pushback of telehealth use. And so when people were trying to seek specialists, especially specialists in rural areas, they had difficulty. Now, a couple things that happened during the pandemic was patients were told not to see doctors because unless you had COVID, I guess nothing else mattered. So you started seeing a fall off of people going to see their primary care doctor for routine complaints, but especially mental health complaints. And what else happened during COVID? Well, mental illness was on the rise for just about everyone. And as an adult, you can remember back a couple years ago now, the anxiety that you felt of what's coming tomorrow. Will I have a job? Will I be able to go out? How are my loved ones doing? Well, if you felt out of control, imagine how your children felt out of school. Mm-hmm. And we have now seen the data on the detriment that it has caused them. So yes, mental illness went rampant, especially in our children, and the access to healthcare. While they say a lot has happened on paper, yes, there's a lot of expansion programs, the telehealth services are actually going away again. And so you're going to find these rural people who are going to have difficulty accessing mental illness healthcare.
I do want to ask about firearm-related deaths because the paper says, quote, firearms play a central role in this crisis. They are the leading cause of death among youths aged 1 to 19 and accounted for nearly half of the increase in the all causes of death in 2020. We have a lot of tense arguments and debates about guns in this country, but no one wants to see a child impacted by gun violence. How do we consider this data, I guess, and does it need to be considered through a political lens if anything is to change on that front?
You can respect and appreciate the right to bear arms, but you also have to acknowledge the data, and the data shows that gun violence is up amongst our children. And people criticize that 18 to 19-year-olds are included in that data. And yes, the majority of gun deaths in children and adolescents fall into that late teen category. But let me tell you, as a mother of three boys, one who's in his early 20s, 18 and 19 year olds, they're still kids when it comes to gun violence. And while 85% of those deaths are from handguns, whether they're being used for suicide or homicide. And so we have to have a broad conversation of what we are doing. I think that we need to make sure that these children do not have access to these guns. And it doesn't matter if there's a mental illness or there's not. There needs to be better safekeeping and more accountability of the adults who have these guns around.
These mortality figures, as stunning as they are, sadly dovetail pretty well with our overall life expectancy in the U.S. We learned late last year that while other wealthier countries saw lifespans rebound in the second year of the pandemic, we in the United States did not. I think we're at just over 76 years of age now with our life expectancy. And you could see that chart. It's sad. You could see this drop off and we're not rebounding. So what do we do?
You know, that's a great question. And that's the reason I wrote my first book, Make America Healthy Again, talking about that. We are living longer, but with that comes some responsibility of making sure we take care of ourselves. You know, the new data that came out of the CDC, they attributed COVID to still a lot of the deaths in 2021. And then they said that there was a decrease in deaths from Alzheimer's, flu, and pneumonia. Well, unfortunately, I think unless you really look at the nitty-gritty of that data, I'm pretty certain that some of those deaths that were labeled as COVID, those patients had Alzheimer's, because the far majority of patients who died from COVID were the elderly, many of which have Alzheimer's. COVID causes a pneumonia. So that's one of the pneumonia deaths. And oftentimes you had people who had dual infections of COVID and flu. So I think that their data is, I don't want to say it's deceitful, but I don't think they're giving a full picture. I think that you were still seeing elderly die in 2021, and that may at an increased rate, and that may still have been to people not going back to the doctor. We have seen that there were a significant drop in cancer detection in 20 and 21 because people weren't going and getting their colonoscopies or their mammograms. People weren't going to the primary care doctor if they were having flu-like symptoms or other things, you know, that had they undergone some treatment for, then maybe it wouldn't have a severe outcome. You also have elderly patients who are taken out of nursing homes, or they're not necessarily getting the geriatric care because they were so afraid about going to healthcare institutions and getting COVID. So people were staying home. So I do think that it will correct itself. I think we're finally starting to get back to where people are feeling comfortable going back to their doctor, going back to healthcare facilities. But it's taking a little bit longer here in the United States, truly, I believe, because our country politicized this virus and this pandemic more than any other country.
I do want to take you back 10 years ago to that bigger study that was done. I forget, shorter lives, poorer health, because they're now saying, like, well, we predicted this lifespan drop. And they said in this report, it was like 400 pages, even Americans with healthy behaviors, those who are not obese or who do not smoke, appear to have higher disease rates than their peers in other countries. I assume having healthy behaviors also means not taking opiates and a myriad of other things, although they specify obesity and tobacco use. But what do we do with that point? If a lot of us as middle-aged folks are just less healthy generally, and we're not overweight or smoking or doing a number of other things that would normally contribute to that.
Well, you definitely picked up on something there. So that report came out a decade ago, right as we were truly starting to see the opioid epidemic, really take rise. And so a lot of those deaths were attributed to opiates. Also, still, there has been a rise in suicides. And I can tell you that we're just having more cancer diagnoses these days. And some of it is genetic, and a lot of it's from our environment as well. And so I can tell you, as someone who delivers a cancer diagnosis every single day, that yes, if you are healthy, you eat well, you exercise, you have great social interactions, you know, bad things can still happen. And so we as a community have to do everything possible that we can to decrease preventable illness, such as maintaining healthy weights and eating healthily, and not smoking, not drinking, not doing drugs, and all those other things that can lead to illness. If we were able to decrease the rampant preventable illness right now, that would provide funds and support for research and care for those that we can't really do anything to prevent. But unfortunately, The majority of our healthcare dollars go towards largely preventable illnesses like cardiovascular disease, preventable cancers, as well as others, as well as opioids.
So that's about going to your doctor then. That's about regularly getting checked and screened and doing all of that.
Absolutely. Early detection truly can save lives. Unfortunately, as we said, we saw a big drop off during the pandemic. Upwards of 50% of people didn't actually get their mammogram in 2020, and about 30% drop off still in 2021. It's taking people a little bit longer to come back, but early detection is really going to help. And the fact that we've now gone a couple of years without it, we are now diagnosing more advanced cancers. So I think that some of these death statistics are going to be a little startling for the next few years, kind of like we see with kids in education. It's going to take a long time for us to come out of this and truly recover.
Finally, doctor, mental health for adults. We saw the CDC statistics in February that teen girls are going through a horrible mental health crisis. Nearly 60% said they felt sad or hopeless. We saw that an alarming number have suicidal thoughts. But when it comes to adults, I was reading that the Kaiser Family Foundation found as of February this year that 32% of adults reported symptoms of depression or anxiety. I imagine that could play a significant role in lifespan, but I don't know.
It certainly can. Having history of any sort of mental illness actually can come with a decreased life expectancy, especially depression. And as we have seen, mental illness throughout the pandemic has increased in not only our children, but adults as well. And unfortunately, there remains a stigma when it comes to mental health, and people tend to not go and seek treatment for mental health the way that they would for some sort of physical health. You have chest pain, you go see a doctor. Well, if you're dealing with depression, you should go see a doctor, because there are also ways to combat that and treat that. But again, people sometimes don't equate them as the same. But it doesn't matter how physically healthy you are. If you haven't taken care of your mental health, it's all for nothing. You have to be strong physically and mentally.
Dr. Nicole Sapphire, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me.
And now, some good news with Tanya J. Powers.
Have you ever wished dogs could talk? Mandy Iworagan might. Her one-year-old Australian shepherd named Nanook took an epic trek across 150 miles of frozen Bering Sea ice before he was safely returned home. His trip included being bitten by a seal or maybe a polar bear. Mandy, who lives in Gambell, Alaska, was visiting a community in the Bering Strait last month when Nanook disappeared with their other family dog, Starlight. Starlight turned up a few weeks later, but Nanook didn't. Then people about 150 miles away in Wales, on Alaska's western coast, started posting pictures online of what they described as a lost dog. Mandy saw them and realized it was Nanook. He flew home last week, catching a ride on a charter carrying athletes for a school district's Native Youth Olympics tournament. There was a happy reunion on the airstrip with Nanook and a joyous Mandy and her daughter. Nanook is now recovering from a swollen leg with large bite marks, but overall, he's in pretty good health and would no doubt have quite the story to tell if he could. Tanya J. Powers, Fox News.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Will Kane.
What's on your mind?
How is it possible that one of America's leading brands, one of the biggest corporations in the world, Anheuser-Busch and Bud Light, could ostracize an audience and a demographic and a nationally cultivated brand over half a century for an audience that makes up less than 1% of the population? Let me introduce you to the Corporate Equality Index. The CEI is a score given by the Human Rights Campaign to America's largest corporations on a scale up to 100. It judges corporations on several different factors, including workplace friendliness, establishment and extension of benefits to LGBTQ, and advertising and marketing and availing yourself to LGBTQ plus audiences. It's important for corporations, in their own estimation, to score high on the CEI, brought to you by the HRC. Why? Because they need investment through ESG. I know, an absolute fire hose of acronyms. ESG, environmental, social, and governance policies incorporated through Wall Street that see America's biggest investment funds and firms saying, you know what? We're going to buy stock. We're going to loan money. We're going to support corporations that satisfy our standards for ESG. And what is one of the factors that helps satisfy ESG? CEI, Corporate Equality Index. What you end up with is a radical minority that dictates the direction of Wall Street, of corporate America, of established brands, of your beer. It's how Bud Light can go from advertising to fratty bros at football games to trans girl Dylan Mulvaney. That's how America has gone woke. For more like this, insight and behind the scenes understanding of what's going on in America's news, check out the Will Cain podcast on Fox News Podcast.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. New from the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for season 3 of my limited time podcast, Everything Will Be Okay, based on my best-selling book of the same name. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.